Isbel heard a long, low, scraping sound, like a slow drawing of a bow across the low string of a deep-toned viol. It was succeeded by silence. She was, by this time, close up to the house, and she looked towards it, but was unable to understand where she had come to. It was a different building. As well as could be distinguished through the mist, it was constructed entirely of unpainted timber, from top to bottom. The roof was flat, without gables, and there appeared to be four stories. Then the fog shut out the vision again. A strange warmth was running through her body. All her other sensations seemed to be merged in the recollection that she was a woman. Fever was abroad in the air, and her blood grew hotter and hotter. The musical noise returned, but now the note was low, fierce, passionate, exactly resembling a deep, forced human cry of love pain. Everything happened in a single second. Between twin periods of fog and gloom came one flash of summer sunlight. It entered upon her with the abrupt unexpectedness of a stroke. And before she realized where she was or what had happened to her, it had departed again, leaving her stunned and terrified. Meanwhile, this is what she seemed to see. She was standing in sunshine again, on that bare hill, gazing at the distant forest across the valley. The sky was cloudless. She was nearly at the top of the hill, and the house had vanished. She recollected everything, but could settle to nothing. Her mood was one of unutterable excitement and reckless audacity. She appeared to herself to be laughing and sobbing under her breath. Henry and that other man were facing each other on the hillside, a little way below her. The man was tall and stout, and in his bright-coloured archaic garments cut an extraordinary figure. He held his instrument against his chest and was in the act of drawing his bow across it. The note she had heard had not yet come to an end. His back was turned towards her, so that she could not see his face, but Henry, who was standing erect and motionless beyond, was looking right into it, and, from his expression, it was as though he were beholding some appalling vision. She screamed and ran towards him, calling him by name. Before she had taken 3 steps, however, the musician jerked his whole force savagely into his bow arm, and she was brought up with a violent shock. Such sharp brutality of passion she had never heard expressed by any sound. The sunlight grew suddenly hotter and darker. The landscape appeared to close rapidly in upon her. Some catastrophe was impending. Her blood was boiling and freezing. At that moment, it seemed to her that yonder strange man was the centre around which everything in the landscape was moving, and that she herself was no more than his dream. And then Henry's face was crossed by an expression of sickness. He changed colour. She caught a faint groan, and directly afterwards he sank helplessly to the ground, where he continued lying quite still. She stood paralysed, staring in horror. The sunlight vanished instantaneously. Everything was grey and cold again. The sky was leaden. She saw nothing but driving rain mists. She rubbed her eyes with her knuckles, wondering what had occurred, how she came to be standing there as in a dream, why she felt sick and troubled. Then she quietly fainted where she stood.
Oh, let me live in doubt.
Chapter 20. Marshall's Journey. On arriving at Lloyd's at 10 o'clock on the same morning, Marshall found among his letters a typewritten envelope of uncommercial size and shape. Out of curiosity, he opened it the first. The communication enclosed was typed on small, feminine notepaper and was neither addressed nor signed. It was, in fact, anonymous. Before reading it, he turned again to the envelope to inspect the postmark. It was stamped Worthing. The only person he could think of as staying at Worthing was Judge. He read the following words. If Mr. Stokes is interested to know how Miss L spends her time during his temporary absences, it might be as well for him to inquire at Runhill Court. There is every reason to believe that she will be there tomorrow, Friday, morning before lunch, for the third time this week. And he may consider the matter of sufficient importance to justify his presence there on the same occasion. Should it not be before lunch, it may be after. It is believed that there are rooms in the house which are not easy to discover. Marshall carefully folded the letter and deposited it in his pocket case. Then he sat back and began slowly to pass his hand over his eyes and forehead. His first impulse was to ignore the whole business, destroy the note, and say nothing about it to Isbell or anyone else. To start testing the accuracy of a charge, of which, naturally, he did not believe a single word, would be equivalent to admitting that there might be a possibility of truth in it. And that would be a ghastly insult to Isbell. But then there was the question of libel. Some ill-disposed person, probably a woman, was evidently bent on mischief, and it was doubtful how far she would go if no counteraction was taken. The thing, obviously, was to find out, in the first place, who wrote the letter. The police were out of the question, and private inquiry agents were not much better. He did not intend to have her name bandied about by these professional gentlemen. She herself was the only one who might be able to throw some light on the business. He would show her the letter that same evening when he went down to Brighton, and they would talk it over together. A person who was prepared to go to that criminal length did not spring out of empty space. Isbell would have a tolerable idea who it was and why she, or he, had done it. Of course, spite was at the bottom of it, but what he could not quite see was the explicit character of the charge. Where was the sense of quoting time and place when the writer must be aware that any action taken on the statement would expose the whole damned lie? Probably it was a bit of low cunning. It was thought that he would not take action and that the poison would continue to rankle in his mind. That seemed all right as far as he could see, and in that case, he was not at all sure that it might not be good policy to make the move he was not expected to make. Of course, before going on to Runhill to see what game was on foot, he would look Isbell up at Brighton, and very likely take her with him. He made hurried arrangements with his deputy to carry on during his absence, and immediately afterwards left for Victoria. It was not long after noon when he arrived at the Gondi Hotel. Mrs. Moore gave an exclamation of surprise when she saw him. "Good gracious! Marshall, what can this mean?" He told a story of having to meet a man. "Where's Isbel?" he added quickly. Isbel, it seemed, had been out for 2 hours, and Mrs. Moore had no idea where she was. In a very discomposed manner, Marshall muttered something about returning later in the day. He took his departure abruptly, almost rudely. She could not think what had come over him. Probably it was some business worry. Meanwhile, Marshall, with a face which grew sterner each minute, sought his car in the hotel garage. While it was being got out, he produced and lit a cigar. He wished to assure himself that his feelings were tranquil, and that the visit to Runhill he was about to make was a quite ordinary matter-of-fact transaction of no special consequence, and undertaken merely as a piece of necessary routine work. Perhaps he really did not see, perhaps he did not wish to see, that it can never be an ordinary transaction to test a woman's honour. He got in, turned up the collar of his rainproof coat, pulled down his crushed-in hat, and started off. It was 1:45. He pushed the car along fast to Shoreham, but once past the houses, he let her go altogether. In just over the half hour, he reached Runhill Lodge. Pridey appeared. Marshall had got down. "Good afternoon. Is there anyone up at the house?" He returned the cigar stump to his mouth when he had spoken. "The bus is there, sir." "Mr. Judge?" "Are?" "Anyone with him?" The keen glint of his eye as he drew a side glance belied his indifferent tone. "No, sir, he's by himself. He ain't been there above half an hour." Marshall remained silent for a minute. "I'll walk up to him, I think. Shall I open the gate?" "No, I said I'd walk up. The car's quite all right where it is. Thank you, Pridey." He threw away his stump, passed through the side gate, and started slowly up the drive with bent head. Pridey, after gazing after him for a short time, disappeared again inside the lodge. The dismal, wetting mist made it no sort of day to be out in. As he approached the house, Marshall saw a small car standing outside the main entrance. It was evidently Judge's. When he came up to it, he leant over the side to make a somewhat ashamed but nonetheless careful scrutiny of the seats and floor. He hardly dared to confess to himself what he feared to see there. It was with heartfelt relief that he failed to detect anything of a compromising character. He crossed to the house. The hall door was unlocked. He opened it and went straight in. The hall was grey, sombre and silent. He wondered which would be the likeliest part of the house to start looking for Judge. 9 chances out of 10 he would be upstairs in his favourite lurking spot, the East Room. It might be good sense to go there first. What did that damned correspondent mean by there being rooms hard to find? Oh, hell! Isbel couldn't be there. Pridey said no one was there except Judge. Why the devil was he wasting precious time mooning in the hall when he ought by now to be up at the top of the house? He made for the main staircase and raced up, 3 steps at a time. Without pausing on the landing, he immediately attacked the upper flight and in less than a minute was groping his way through the black darkness of the upstairs corridor. He saw at once that the door of the east room was standing open. Upon getting closer, he saw something else. A man was lying, huddled and motionless on the floor near one of the walls. It required no flash of inspiration to guess that it was Judge. But what had happened to him? Was he asleep, fainting, or drunk? He leapt over to him and pulled his face round, then let go again in horror. The man was dead. There was no doubt of the fact. There was little doubt of the cause of death. The discoloured face told its own story. Apoplexy. To make quite sure, he tested the heart. After crouching for at least 5 minutes with his hand on Judge's naked chest, he saw that it was hopeless to go on. There was not the faintest whisper of a heartbeat. He did whatever he thought was immediately necessary, then walked quickly away and downstairs to fetch assistance. The unexpected tragedy had put his own affair entirely out of his head. He had forgotten Isabel's connection with the house and, for the moment, almost her very existence. He was too preoccupied with his immediate plans for action to see anything around him. Otherwise, upon reaching the head of the main staircase, he would at once have perceived straight ahead of him Isabel herself, sitting in a chair near the other end of the hall. As it was, it was not until he was close upon her that he jumped back with a start. Her face was white, her eyes were closed, her clothing appeared to be wet and stained with mud, while her whole attitude was one of lassitude and exhaustion. Isabel! What does this mean? He came on again until he nearly stood over her. She opened her eyes slowly and looked up with weary indifference, manifesting no surprise at his presence, nor, indeed, any emotion whatever. "How did you get here?" was all she asked. "Oh, never mind me. How do you come to be in this house?" "I fainted outside and came in here to sit down before going home."
"Outside? What were you doing outside? What are you doing in this part of the world at all?"
It was several seconds before she answered. "Don't be hard on me, Marshall. I can't explain now. I have a confession to make, but not now." He whipped the anonymous letter out of his pocket case and handed it to her. "Will you read that?" She did so, while he watched her closely. His heart sank as he saw that she showed neither astonishment nor indignation. She read it through twice, quite apathetically, and then passed it back without a word.
"Well?"
demanded Marshall. I know who wrote that. Is that what you want?"
Never mind who wrote it. Is it true?"
"Perhaps it isn't true, but it was written in good faith. I meant to come here this morning with Mr. Judge, but he disappointed me."
I see. May I ask why?"
But he was unable to finish.
"Why I wished to be here with him?"
She smiled bitterly. "Please, Don't press me to give explanations which you won't receive. There was a dead silence.
Then you haven't seen him today?
Asked Marshall.
I can't say. I don't know. I don't know whom I've seen and whom I haven't seen. I have fainted. I don't know anything. So perhaps you don't know where he is at this moment?
That I'll swear to, Marshall. I've only just this minute entered the house for the first time.
Then I'll tell you. He's upstairs, in the east room.
He looked at her, to see if she were as ignorant of the tragedy as her words and manner professed, but she did not even appear interested.
Dead,
he added, suddenly and brutally. Isabel half rose from her seat and turned such a greenish colour that he thought she was about to swoon again, but he did not go to her assistance. She recovered herself by an effort.
"Have you killed him?"
she demanded quietly.
"I have not. I don't believe in private assassinations. He's had some sort of fit. And now I'm off to tell Pridey and fetch a doctor. We had better resume this very interesting conversation later. And if I may venture to offer a suggestion, there will probably be an inquest, and if you have no special desire to appear among the witnesses, it would be as well for you to lose no time in getting clear of the premises. Does anyone know you're here, barring Judge himself?
No.
What? Then how did you get in?
By another gate.
Well, take my advice and go out by the same way. Can you find your way to the main Stenning Road?
I expect so.
Then walk on, and I'll pick you up in the car further on. I've got to fetch a doctor, so you'll be there as soon as I shall. Go now. Don't waste time.
Isabel remained sitting. Marshall,
what is it?
How long has he been dead?
Pridey says he's only been in the house half an hour. That was 15 minutes ago, perhaps. He can't have been dead long. Why?
Because I feel as if something has snapped inside me since I fell down in that faint. It must have been at the same time. Do you think it's strange that I don't express a wish to go up and see him?
I'm exceedingly sorry, Isabel, but I can't enter into your wishes or feelings. Of course, there's not the slightest need for you to go up, and I strongly advise you not to.
She directed a pitiful smile towards him. I know there's no going back to the old state. Please don't imagine that I even wish to. I merely want to tell you that perhaps my feelings towards him were not altogether what you think they were.
But you came here to meet him?
Isabel dived into her handbag impulsively. Marshall, you've shown me a letter. Now I'll show you one. Read that. He took it rather unwillingly and skimmed it through.
Who is this Mrs. Richborough he speaks about?
The person who wrote to you.
Oh, that seems a fatal business all round. And is this letter of Judge's a blind, or did it really extend no further?
I wish you to believe that Mr. Judge was a man of honour. That's all. Now I'll go. I won't insult you by expressing my sorrow for the position I've put you in. You have always been awfully good to me, and I'm afraid I've repaid you in the meanest possible way. Goodbye for the time being. She got up and started to stumble towards the door.
Do you feel yourself able to walk as far as I proposed?
Asked Marshall in a singular tone. She stopped to look back over her shoulder. It seems to me that I have no alternative.
That's quite true. I can't come with you, for I have this awful business to attend to. How long will it take you to get clear of the grounds by the way you're going?
I don't know. 10 minutes?
I'll sit here for 10 minutes by my watch and then make my way to the lodge. Walk on towards Stenning, and if I haven't picked you up by the time you have reached there, wait for me at the station. Is that clear?
Yes, Marshall.
Incidentally, how did you get here?
By hired car from Worthing, but I dismissed the driver short of the house.
All right, then. You'd better clear off.
He sat down in the chair which he had vacated and pulled out his watch. Isabel hesitated a moment as if she wished to say something more, but then a flash of anger at her own weakness seemed to come across her, for she suddenly straightened herself and walked directly to the door. 10 minutes later, Marshall rose, left the house, and started down the drive towards the lodge. It was nearing 4 o'clock when he and Isabel returned to the Gondi together. Isabel went straight to her room. Marshall sought Mrs. Moore and, without beating about the bush, informed her that the engagement was broken off by mutual agreement. He referred her to Isabel for all explanations. She was greatly upset, but had too much good sense to attempt to combat his decision there and then, without learning more about the affair. She wished him Godspeed and begged him, with tears in her eyes, at least to leave the road open for future negotiations. However, he declined to make any kind of promise or to discuss things with her at all. He spent the night at the hotel but dined out and retired to his room early. On the following morning, he packed his belongings, settled his bill, and started back to town in the car, without having attempted previously to see Mrs. Moore for the purpose of saying farewell. The inquest was held on Tuesday. Marshall was called upon to give evidence as to the finding of the body, but everything was purely formal. The medical witness certified that death was due to cerebral hemorrhage, and the jury returned their verdict accordingly. Isabel did not attend. The two ladies returned to Kensington as arranged in the middle of the week. Isabel refused to discuss matters with her aunt or to see any of her friends. Blanche behaved with great tact. She neither wrote to her nor called, but she was continually sending flowers and kind messages by way of Mrs. Moore, and Isabel was not ungrateful. A few weeks afterwards, aunt and niece went to the Riviera. Blanche thought the occasion propitious to resume a correspondence with her friend, and Isabel acquiesced, though without any particular pleasure. The first letters were very correct, but as time passed, Marshall's name began to appear on Blanche's side with greater frequency. In the beginning, Isabel thought that it was an unintentional blundering against good taste, It was not long before she realized that the thin edge of the wedge had become too securely hammered in to be easily dislodged. She passed over the illusions in silence. Then the time came for them to return home. It was March.
"I want to know how we're to stand, Billy," wrote her friend. "We see a good deal of Marshall in these days. If you happen to run up against him in my house, may I take it that you will behave towards him with common politeness?" Isabel wrote back, "If Marshall is able to endure my society, I shall certainly be able to endure his." On the evening of the same day that Blanche received this letter, she showed these lines to Marshall himself. He coloured violently.
"Well, how am I to answer?" she demanded.
"Tell her I'm not quite a savage."
"Is that all?"
"Don't you think we'd better take one step at a time?" asked Marshall. Blanche smiled and suddenly grasped his wrist.